Buddha, for example, or Confucius, for example.
Or any other historical figure.
Yeah, up until today, I mean, their words are highly regarded by many people. And I don't want to criticize that. The point is that why, when it comes only to prophets and the religion of Islam, they just mention that we have such a great gap between our time and the time of the prophet.
Right.
So we have the same issues. I mean, these people were genius, and that is why their books continue to be taught and studied by the people. When it comes to our prophet, we believe that he was not only a genius, he was also a divinely appointed prophet. So this is just an excuse. If there is any critic, come and talk about that point, a weak point in the religion of Islam. You cannot generalize your point by saying that it is outdated. No.
Right. And with that, we will have to end today's program because we are unfortunately out of time. I thank the dear Sheikh for joining us today and for sharing with us his knowledge. And I also thank you, the dear listeners, for tuning in. Until next time. في أمان الله
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. The world's forests play a far greater and more complex role in tackling climate crisis than previously thought, due to their physical effects on global and local temperatures, according to new research. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Nina Lahane. The piece is titled The world's forests do more than just store carbon, new research finds. The world's forests play a far greater and more complex role in tackling climate crisis than previously thought, due to their physical effects on global and local temperatures, according to new research. The role of forests as carbon sponges is well established, but comprehensive new data suggests that forests deliver climate benefits well beyond just storing carbon, helping to keep air near and far cool and moist due to the way they physically transform energy and water. The new study, which is the first to pinpoint the non-carbon dioxide benefits of different forests, found that the band of tropical rainforests spanning Latin America, Central Africa, and Southeast Asia generate the most local and global benefits. Researchers from the United States and Colombia found that overall forests keep the planet at least half a degree Celsius cooler when biophysical effects, from chemical compounds to turbulence and the reflection of light, are combined with carbon dioxide. In the tropics, from Brazil and Guatemala to Chad, Cameroon and Indonesia, the cooling effect is more than 1 degree Celsius. In short, while all forests provide multiple benefits, some are more important than others in keeping the climate stable. Despite the mounting evidence that forests deliver myriad climate benefits, trees are still viewed just as sticks of carbon by many policymakers in the climate change arena, said Louis Verschot, principal scientist at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture and co-author of the new study, The Unseen Effects of Deforestation, Biophysical Effects on Climate. Forests are key to mitigation, but also adaptation. Deforestation has devastating impacts on biodiversity, on food security, and on global warming. A recent report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, warned about catastrophic consequences humanity faces with rising temperatures. The findings, published in the journal Frontiers in Forests and Global Change, suggest that forests are important to mitigation and adaptation, cooling the air and protecting us from droughts, from extreme heat and floods caused by the climate breakdown. Forest cooling is due to a range of biophysical effects, such as the physical aspect of the tree's wood, leaves and density, as opposed to biochemical factors such as the carbon. Researchers found that forests emit chemicals called biogenic volatile organic compounds, or BVOCs, which create aerosols that reflect incoming energy and form clouds. Both are cooling effects. While they also lead to a build-up of two greenhouse gases, ozone and methane, on balance, the cooling outweighs the warming. Deep roots, efficient water use, and so-called canopy roughness also enable forests to mitigate the impact of extreme heat. These physical qualities allow trees to move heat and moisture away from the Earth's surface where we live, which directly cools the local area and influences cloud formation and rainfall, which has ramifications far away. In the tropics, where forest carbon storage and sequestration rates are highest, the biophysical effects of forests amplify the carbon benefits. In other words, tropical deforestation immediately increases extreme heat locally and decreases regional and local rainfall. The biophysical factors don't cool the planet, but they do change the way we experience heat, and that matters, said Deborah Lawrence, a professor at the University of Virginia and one of the lead authors of the new report. Professor Deborah Lawrence added, "The heart of the tropics is at the heart of the planet, and these forests are critical for our survival." Better protection, expansion and improved management of the world's forests are considered by many experts as among the most promising nature-based solutions. Michael Coe, the Tropics Program Director at the Woodwell Climate Research Center and a co-author of the new study, says, "Without the forest cover, we have now the planet would be hotter and the weather more extreme. Forests provide us defense against the worst-case global warming scenarios.
On February 28th, a few days after the Russian troops attacked Ukraine, FIFA decided to suspend Russia from international competition, a sharp break with tradition. Since its foundation in 1904, the international body has almost been indifferent to the political acts and, in fact, to the ethical failings of member states. FIFA let Nazi Germany take part in the 1938 World Cup. It didn't ban France from the World Cups of the 1950s, despite that country's bloody wars against independence movements in Algeria and Indochina. FIFA also didn't have any problem with the Argentinian junta, which executed its own people inside football stadiums that went on to host the 1978 World Cup finals. FIFA also allowed Nigeria to compete in the 1970 World Cup qualifiers, despite its government waging a war against Biafrans, which resulted in up to 2 million deaths by starvation. The list goes on.
The injustice is still there, the deprivation is still there, the subjugation is still there, the envy, greed and jealousy towards the Biafrans are still there from predominantly the Hausa Fulani segment of this country they call Nigeria. So all those indices are still present, but unfortunately it's not been addressed. So we wish to deal with it once and for all. What we are doing will bring an end to it, but I don't know for sure. And it will not, the future generations to come will not have to contend with this very issue anymore. That's something we're here to make certain of.
Meanwhile, constant calls in FIFA to suspend Israel over its treatment of Palestinians have fallen on deaf ears.
This protest is to show the FIFA Council that there is racism. The land that we are marching towards is land that belongs to these children and their families behind us, yet they're not allowed to access it, and they're not allowed to build football stadiums or even schools on their land.
So the immediate question is, what is different in the case of Russia? If attacking another country is FIFA's red line to national teams, then FIFA should have taken the same measures against the US and the UK for their actions in Afghanistan and Iraq, or against the Saudi-led coalition for its bloody campaign in Yemen, or even against Brazil for its mistreatment of indigenous populations, to name but a few. Through all these years, FIFA has been indifferent, justifying its silence on the basis that football is apolitical and no national team should be excluded for political reasons. Against such a backdrop, Russia's almost immediate suspension has raised many eyebrows. Is football political or not? It seems that FIFA has no clear, honest answer to this question.
It's the first time ever that FIFA organizes such an event, such an important event, because at the end of the day, and we forget that very often, especially we, on our part, we forget what football is about. We are maybe into our political things, and we forget that we actually have to focus on the pitch, focus on what is happening. And for this reason, to have this gathering here in London, in this weekend where we celebrate also the best coaches, the best players, best teams and so on and so forth, is certainly not only symbolic, but should lead us for the future to focus even more on what happens in the pitch. Bring football back to FIFA and FIFA back to football. And this is the message we want to give you. And we wanted to give it to you by having you all here after such an incredible World Cup. A World Cup which worked very well, I said it, off the pitch.
Following an extraordinary meeting in late February, UEFA, FIFA's European counterpart, announced this season's Champions League final would be moved from St. Petersburg as a result of the current escalation. In the words of Sean Jacobs, Associate Professor of International Affairs at the New School, we have seen the Western double standards on full display the most the last few weeks. FIFA and UEFA, which control global and continental football in Europe respectively, went from hedging about the war to an outright suspension of all Russian national and club teams from its competitions. If anti-Russian sentiments form one side of the two governing bodies in football, supporting the occupation regime of Israel unconditionally is the other ugly side of both FIFA and UEFA.
Had a clear-cut mandate by the last Congress to take the decision, to decide whether the Israeli sport activities in the occupied Palestinian territories is violating or not either the statutes of FIFA or the Security Council of the UN.
In 2009, to celebrate a goal against Sudan in an African Cup match, Egyptian footballer Mohamed Abu Trika lifted his shirt to reveal a message on his T-shirt underneath, which said, "Sympathize with Gaza." FIFA gave him an official warning and insisted that it had a strict ban on such political statements.
This is a state which killed 2,000 people last summer, defenceless people in Gaza, 500 of them children. And the world, including our government, allows them to operate with impunity.
In a grave violation of its own rules, now FIFA not only doesn't warn footballers, but also encourages them around the world to show their solidarity with Ukraine. FIFA has reiterated its condemnation of Russia's use of force in its attack on Ukraine, saying violence is never a solution, and FIFA expresses its deepest solidarity to all people affected by what is happening in Ukraine. In 2016, Celtic FC was fined by UEFA after the Scottish club's fans displayed Palestinian flags during a match against Israel's Hapoel Baal Shiva. UEFA said back then that its rules forbid the use of gestures, words, objects or any other means to transmit any message that is not fit for a sports event, particularly messages that are of a political, ideological, religious, offensive or provocative nature. But these acts of hypocrisy don't confine to the realm of football. In early March, the International Judo Federation, IJF, announced the cancellation of all its competitions in Russia. It had already decided to cancel the Kazan Grand Slam tournament, which was due to take place from May 20th to 22nd in Kazan, Russia. The IJF's overtly political decision is the contrast to what it pretends to be. In April last year, Iran was suspended by judo's world governing body as punishment for refusing to let its athletes face opponents from Israel, in other words, for politicizing sports. Iranian athletes refraining from facing Israeli opponents has been a fixture since the Islamic Republic's establishment in 1979. This symbolic gesture is meant to protest the Israeli occupation of Palestine, but it has always been attacked as a political act in sports. But now it's become obvious that the concept of sports being apolitical has zero credibility. The case of Russia speaks volumes.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we would like to begin by offering our congratulations to our esteemed listeners, because as you know, in a lot of Muslim countries, the month of Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, has commenced. And for a lot of Muslims in other countries, the month of Ramadan hasn't commenced, you know, tomorrow might be the first day of Ramadan. So we'd like to, in any case, offer our congratulations to our listeners on this most auspicious day. The month of Ramadan is a month of dua and prayer. And a lot of Muslims in non-Muslim countries or with non-Muslim relatives and friends, they ask, in this month of Ramadan, can we ask God for, you know, forgiveness for our non-Muslim friends and relatives and things like this? The reason why a lot of people ask this question is that we have some verses in the Holy Quran which seem to say that this is not permissible. For example, in one verse of the Holy Quran, God is very clear. He says to the Prophet, if you ask forgiveness for them, or do not ask forgiveness for them, doesn't matter. Even if you ask forgiveness for them 70 times, God will never forgive them, because they disbelieve in God and the Prophet, and God does not guide a transgressing nation. Right? So this verse of the Holy Quran is very clear. It says that it's useless to ask forgiveness for them, because they have no capacity, they have no capability, there's no potential in them for forgiveness. So this is a useless endeavor to ask forgiveness for them. Right? So keeping in mind verses like this or other verses, you know, a lot of people ask whether, you know, can we, you know, pray for non-Muslims or not. Based on, certain other verses of the Holy Quran, we can understand and gather that this is up to the point where we are sure that such people cannot be guided, as we can clearly see from this verse, right? God says here is because they disbelieve in God and the Prophet, and God cannot guide a transgressing lot, you cannot ask forgiveness for them. Obviously, the converse of this is that, you know, if there is a shade of, you know, possibility that they could be guided, this possibility and the permissibility of praying for them is intact. You know, this goes back to another discussion, and that is the different categories of disbelief, right? Different categories of disbelief. And this is something that we can gather from a lot of verses of the Holy Quran. There's different categories of disbelievers. There's a group of disbelievers who the Quran calls or labels with a term we call the mustaz'afin, those who are weakened or who have been oppressed in the land, right? And there's another group of people who the Quran labels the mu'anideen or the jahideen, right? Those people who understand the truth, right? Who understand the truth. They're certain about the truth, that Islam is correct, the correct religion, that God exists and all these things, but they still, out of enmity or for whatever reason, out of greed, love of the world, right? They choose to, disbelieve and not submit to the truth, right? So what we are sure about, what we can be sure about is that this impermissibility, this prohibition, is only for those, non-Muslims who fall under that second category, not the first category. And this is attested to by another fact. In a very famous prayer from Imam Sajjad, and this prayer is interesting, this prayer has been to be recited in Ramadan, right? Imam Sajjad alayhi salam prays for all people, regardless of whether, prays for human beings, regardless of whether they're Muslims or non-Muslims. He prays for them, for their safety, for their, you know, sustenance, for their happiness, you know, and for their return back home, right? So this indicates that, yes, this is permissible with the condition and the clause that we mentioned earlier. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the permissibility of praying for non-Muslims according to the verses of the Holy Quran and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the West implements draconian sanctions against Russia, including the banning of the Russian news outlets RT and Sputnik from YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok, as well as search engine results, social media censorship of political messaging about the Palestinian liberation struggle continues. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Omar Zahza, writer. This article is published under the heading Social Media Giants Repress Palestinian Content. Here's the story. Silicon Valley is solidly entrenching itself as a devoted enemy of political dissent. As the West implements draconian sanctions against Russia, including the banning of the Russian news outlets RT and Sputnik from YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok, as well as search engine results, social media censorship of political messaging about the Palestinian liberation struggle continues. On March 8, Instagram, owned by Facebook's Meta Platforms, deleted the main account of the organization Within Our Lifetime, or WOL, a New York City-based Palestinian community organization. The social media account was removed over a post that highlighted revolutionary Palestinian women in commemoration of International Women's Day. WOL explained that their account was suspended after years of online censorship and shadow banning. Shadow banning is the practice of restricting social media content that is not noticeable to the user. While companies like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube once styled themselves protectors of free speech given the highly publicized use of their platforms, their actions over the following years have proved otherwise. As the Electronic Frontier Foundation noted in 2020, rampant censorship on social media is targeted against the very same regions these platforms initially used to promote their ostensible values of free speech. When pressed in the past, social media companies provided vague responses that only focused on technical issues and did not adequately explain the high rate and diverse types of censorship documented by rights advocates, according to the Palestinian digital rights group Hamle. The targeting of WOL's Instagram account shows that we need to whitewash our history as an organization in order to survive on social media. These actions show there is a limit to how much history, culture, and politics you're allowed to express, WOL chair Nardin Keswani told the Electronic Entawasa. Keswani explained that the post initially received a disciplinary action called a strike from Instagram, which she said was common. Historically, she explained, Instagram would strike WOL posts with no clear pattern. The company even flagged a January post about a Palestinian prisoner, Hesham Abu Hawash, being infected with COVID-19 while in the Zionist regime hospital. Why should we assume that a post about a Palestinian prisoner getting COVID is going to get a strike? Keswani said. Keswani explained that the Women's Day post not only received a strike, but Instagram also sent a warning that the entire WOL account could be deleted permanently. Following this warning, WOL organizers found themselves unable to access the account. They launched a social media campaign to pressure Instagram to restore the account, and on March 12th, received an email from Instagram saying only that the account had been disabled by mistake and it would be restored. WOL stated, while the restoration of our main account following a massive outpouring of support from our comrades and supporters around the world marks a victory, we know that Instagram continues to uphold anti-Palestinian racism and actively works directly with our oppressors to silence us. But activists noted that Instagram's lack of transparency and seemingly arbitrary punitive measures indicate that the platform remains an embattled site for liberation-focused political messaging about Palestine. A member of the grassroots organization Palestinian Youth Movement, who asked to remain anonymous, told the Electronic Intifada that the group has had its social media activity heavily challenged since at least 2018, when Facebook began disappearing their post about protest for the 70th anniversary of the Nakba. The PYM member explained, "We wouldn't have the option to invite people to the protest, and we continued receiving messages saying that our page was not being recommended to people." The digital repression escalated in May 2021 when PYM began working with the Yemeni Liberation Movement on actions including a hunger strike opposing U.S. support for the Saudi-led blockade against the Yemeni people. The PYM member mentioned that after the collaboration with the Yemeni movement, their social media began to experience heavy shadow banning to the point that PYM organizers would have to manually instruct followers to seek out their group's posts, which were not visible to them otherwise. While one can only speculate about the precise reasons for such restrictions, Instagram itself has admitted to limiting the visibility of the content it deems inappropriate even when the posts in question don't run afoul of the platform's community guidelines. Laura L. Borno is a Palestinian-American lawyer and podcast host who uses social media to call attention to the Palestinian liberation struggle. She told the Electronic Intifada that her personal Instagram account swelled to more than 40,000 followers after the world's attention turned to the Zionist regime's planned expulsions of Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah and the Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza in May 2021. She said, "But with more followers came increased repression. Several of my posts would be deleted by Instagram for alleged hate speech or violence." She says that some of the deleted posts included images of Zionists calling for a second Nakba and a photo of her brother-in-law's apartment building in Gaza after it had been struck by an Israeli regime airstrike. "Surely Instagram's guidelines cannot possibly be intended to prevent victims of violence and hate speech from sharing their experiences," El Borno said. Adding, "Every time I appealed Instagram's censorship of my post, Instagram would restore my post saying it never should have been deleted in the first place." El Borno explained that her posts were also subjected to shadow banning and had received frequent threats of deletion from Instagram. Despite none of her posts violating the company's guidelines, she also began losing hundreds of followers. El Borno provided several examples of social media repression to a Human Rights Watch report on the issue. On March 8, Instagram deleted the account for El Borno's podcast, The Palestine Pod. The platform initially provided no reason for the deletion, she said. Instagram even initially refused to review the deletion of the account due to El Borno's inability to provide company documents like articles of incorporation or a utility bill, documents which Instagram said they required in order to restore the account. These documents do not exist, El Borno explained, as the Palestinian Pod is a self-produced podcast show. Only after launching a social media campaign through the host's own individual accounts, as well as outreach on their behalf by the civil rights group Palestine Legal, was the account restored. El Borno and her co-host, Michael Scherzer, were informed by an email from Instagram's corporate office that the account was flagged for suspicious behavior either by scrapping information from Instagram, using an app or service to interact with Instagram in unauthorized ways, or because the account was shared or compromised. But again, none of the reasons were applicable to the podcast Instagram account activities. And once it was restored, El Borno and Scherzer received dozens of messages from fans who said they had been involuntarily kicked off of the account's followers list.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, the importance of employment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the importance of the employment in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the employment and its importance, we see that Islam has given a specific importance to this topic. And Islam wants every Muslim to work hard. And even in the economics, where in the capitalism, a person can buy things and become honored, in Islam it is said that if a person harvests or he works hard, whatever he has done through that, he can gain the ownership of something and not buy money. And if there is a person who just spends money, who buys things through the money and he does not put any effort into that work, this is not a kind of ownership that is being said in the Islamic economics, in the Islamic teachings. Therefore, it is important to work hard. And we can see that in the life of every prophet, that all prophets, they used to work hard. And they were shepherds, they used to work for the others. But the point is, they were working. They were going out and working. And through that work, they used to bring sustenance for their family. They used to bring some rizq for their family. They had income through the work which they used to do. And it is in the life of the prophets. We can see that there were many prophets who were working in the fields by themselves, where they had many people, many followers. They never asked their followers to do that. They used to do it by themselves. And even they used to feed the other companions as well in their life, and they used to bring sustenance for the community and for their family as well. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of importance of employment in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that the prophets also, all the prophets, They used to work hard. And when we look at the history, we see that in some of the narrations, there are some stories about the Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam. And it is said that when Prophet Jesus was with his companions, and whenever his companions used to become hungry, they used to ask him and used to say, Ya Ruhullah, oh, the Spirit of Allah, oh, the Jesus, we are hungry. Can you ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to send some food for us? Therefore, he used to knock the earth and he used to bring two breads for them. And after that, whenever they used to become thirsty, he used to pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the water was present in front of them. And they were thinking, these companions of the Prophet Jesus were thinking that the food is being given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The water that we drink, it's also been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because we have this Prophet who is praying for us and who is bringing and giving this sustenance for us. So we are the best people on this earth, and there is no one who is better than us. Therefore, they asked the Prophet Jesus that, are we the best, or is there anyone, afzalu, is there anyone who is better than us? And then the Prophet Jesus replied to them, أَفْزَلُ مِنْكُمْ مَنْ يَعْمَلُ بِيَدِهِ وَيَأْكُلُ مِنْ كَسْبِهِ. Know that the best of you amongst you is the one who works with his hands and he eats from what he earned through this working. And therefore, after that, these companions of Prophet Jesus, they started to wash people's clothes, and through that they had their earning. They used to wash the clothes of people, they used to ask them, and through this they had their own income. So this shows us that when we talk about the working in the Islamic lifestyle, it is not just in Islam, but from Prophet Adam alayhi salam till the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the all prophets and their companions, they used to work, and every single prophet has commanded their companions, their followers, and the people who were following them to work hard, to work with these hands that are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, we also need to pay attention to this topic, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Researchers are concerned that data gaps could make it harder to spot the next COVID-19 variant of concern and could frustrate efforts to respond to it quickly. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Smriti Malapati Ryder. This article is published under the heading Genome Data Gaps Could Stymie Search for Next COVID Variant. Here's more. Sequencing SARS-CoV-2 genomes have helped researchers to track how the virus is evolving, but many countries aren't sharing all their data. Many countries sequencing SARS-CoV-2 genomes are sharing only a fraction of them on public repositories, and many sequences are missing important information according to a global analysis of genomic surveillance. But the study also found that despite these challenges, countries have become faster at sharing sequences over the course of the pandemic. Openly sharing genome sequencing data from SARS-CoV-2 samples has allowed researchers to track how the virus is evolving and has become a hallmark of the pandemic. But researchers are concerned that data gaps could make it harder to spot the next COVID-19 variant of concern and could frustrate efforts to respond to it quickly. Nilika Malavich, an immunologist at the University of Sri Jayapundra in Colombo, said sharing data is absolutely important for everybody's survival. In the study published in the Nature Genetics recently, researchers collected genomic data uploaded to public repositories, including GISAID, between the beginning of the pandemic and October 31, 2021. Comprising roughly 4.9 million genomes from 169 countries. They compared those sequences with official reports from individual countries and found that 62 countries that report those data, 23 more than one-third, had uploaded fewer than 50% of their sequences from the variants of concern Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and Delta. About one-quarter of countries had uploaded fewer than 25% of their sequences. The lack of sharing is a global problem, says co-author Andrew Asman, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, adding, "It's not just a rich or poor country thing." The authors suggest several reasons that some countries might not share all their sequences on public repositories. It's possible that some of the samples were not sequenced in the first place because there are ways of identifying variants of concern without sequencing the full genomes, says Asman. And depending on the sequencing technology that researchers have used, some samples were probably not of sufficient quality to upload, explains Cynthia Saloma, a molecular biologist at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City. But a chunk of unshared sequences are probably being held back for political reasons, including the repercussions of being the first country to report a new variant of concern. Most countries that share those data usually are made to suffer for it, says Nedodo, a molecular bioengineer at the Nigeria Center for Disease Control in Abuja. For example, when researchers in South Africa and Botswana alerted the world to the Omicron variant last November, a slew of countries responded by shutting their borders to the region. In some countries, governments need to review and approve sequences before they are uploaded. Governments of tourism-dependent nations might ask their labs not to share the data because of the impact it will have, said Malavich. But Asman says data sharing is only part of the story. Some countries share a high proportion of their samples, but have sequenced only a handful of genomes, he says. The researchers found that 87 countries were routinely sequencing samples, but 31 were not. And the team couldn't find information about the genomic surveillance strategies for another 76. Globally, no more than 4.5% of confirmed COVID-19 cases were sequenced every week from September 2020 onwards, with large discrepancies across regions, from a total of 3.4% genomes sequenced in Europe during the study period to 0.1% in the Eastern Mediterranean. Some countries, including Norway, the UK and Canada, have sequenced at least 10% of their culminative cases. The study also assessed the quality of metadata uploaded to GISAID by 169 countries. It found that 63% of sequences did not include information about the age and sex of the person they were sampled from, and more than 95% were missing clinical information such as symptom severity and the vaccination status of the infected person. Higher-income countries tended to provide fewer metadata than did lower-income regions. Metadata are especially important when a new variant emerges to assess who is most at risk, how well existing vaccines and drugs will work, and the conditions that could have led to its emergence, says researchers. Again, there could be many reasons for the information gaps, such as data privacy concerns and that the collection of metadata can't keep up with the pace of samples being sequenced. Sometimes a sample might be missing metadata but have come from a remote province, making it too precious not to share, says Nino Susanto, a bioengineer who heads the COVID-19 testing lab, GSI Lab in Jakarta. Despite data sharing challenges, the study also found that countries have become faster at sharing sequences during the pandemic. In 2020, it took close to 3 months on average for researchers in most countries to collect, sequence, and upload genomic data to public repositories. However, that fell to 20 days by the time the Delta variant emerged in 2021. As Van says, this pandemic has normalized sharing.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of the speech delivered on March 10th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the 9th session of the Assembly. The Assembly of Experts is a legal institution that plays a great part in the strength of the Islamic government. Of course, all legal institutions, the administration, the parliament, the armed forces, the expediency council, the guardian council, and the like, have a part, each in the strength of the Islamic government, but some play a greater and some a lesser role. In my opinion, the Assembly of Experts is one of those institutions that plays the biggest role in the Islamic Republic. Of course, the prerequisite for all these legal institutions to exert their influence is to act according to the regulations and the limits defined for them by the Constitution. The same is true of your institution. In other words, you should completely comply with everything that is required of the Assembly of Experts, whether regarding the person who currently holds the position of leadership or the person who will be elected by you and who will enter this arena later on. You should carefully comply with these regulations.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The same is true of the parliament and the administration. The administration has specific legal limits, and it must comply with all the laws passed by the parliament. The parliament, too, has specific legal limits, and it should not get involved in executive affairs in any way. It must only engage in legislation. The same holds true for other institutions as well. Well, the necessity for the strength of the Islamic government, which, as I said, the parliament and other institutions play a part in, lies in that if this strength exists, national power and strength will be realized. National power is vital for every nation. If a nation wishes to be independent and honorable, if it wants to utilize its vital resources at its own violation and to its own benefits, if it wants to have full power over its own affairs, if it doesn't wish to have to follow this and that whims, if it wants to have no worries about foreigners, transgressions, and if it does not want to live in constant fear, what should it do? It should be strong.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
سعید پورزا، لندن.
راشان سگلم، استانبول.
سید امین عالمی، کابل.
شاهان بات، ایندین ادمنستریت کشمیر.
Around the world with reporters.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of